I'm an alcoholic. My name is John Kane.
Hi, John.
I am very pleased to be here. All of us Yankees have heard the line of a song that nothing could be finer than to be in Caroline in the morning. We thought that was true until we got to this meeting. Thank God that Wallace is from the South, because the first guy up here didn't say, I thought we were in Scotland. I serve as the area chair for Area 45 of a General Service Conference of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's southern New Jersey, which goes approximately from Princeton, New Jersey, over to Barnegat Light, south to Cape May. We are structured with 29 districts, one of which is a Spanish-speaking district. We have four sections, or DCMs at large. We have 14 standing committees. We're part of the Northeast region of Alcoholics Anonymous and have, therefore, a Northeast regional trustee. We have, in our area, at least one meeting in every correctional facility and treatment facility in our area. Treatment facilities are closing. In our even the detoxes in the hospitals, most recently in our Shore area, just before the summer began, and the Shore area is a resort area, the Burdett Tomlin Hospital in Wildwood, New Jersey, and the Shore Memorial Hospital in Summers Point, New Jersey, closed their detoxes. So we have a lot to do to carry the message. We believe that our primary purpose is to carry the message, and we have the support of three inner groups in our area. One is in the Trenton area, one is in the Camden area, and one is in the Shore area. And we really cooperate really well with each other, and we have a lot of enthusiasm. We ask a lot of people to get involved, and we ask everybody who gets involved to wear a couple of hats. And we're very, very, very fortunate to have a lot of commitment. We have two things going on up there in the next couple of months. Other than our regular convention, we are in October in Cape May, New Jersey, right on the ocean. We're the host to the Northeast Regional Alcoholics Anonymous Convention. And in February of 1996, we'll host the Northeast Regional Alcoholics Anonymous Service Assembly. So we're a service-oriented area. We have a newsletter, we have a convention, and we have all of these committees, and we have all of these people who came down here today who dedicate, they really render prodigies of service. And what we're going to do is to try and introduce, we have a cross-section of all those things I just described here. And our first speaker is Joe H. And Joe is responsible for Maximum Security Prison, Riverfront Prison in Camden, New Jersey. All of us, by the way, are probably transplanted Philadelphians as well. You know, Philadelphia's right across the river. And so when they wouldn't have us in Philadelphia, we all round up in Jersey. Three of us have evidently been born in the same hospital, so there's got to be something in the water in Philadelphia. But Joe is what we call a DCM at large. He is Section 2. He is responsible for the coordination of about eight other DCMs in the area, and he's also the coordinator for the maximum security prison at Riverfront. And he renders prodigies of service. He works all the time. And without further ado, I give you Joe H.
Thank you. I'm Joe. I'm an alcoholic. I see most of you have handles down here, too. I heard of Monster last night and this morning Blade, and my handle is Lollipop, so I'm Lollipop Joe. I bring those lollipops. Tonight we'll get some. I didn't want to get them in this morning because, you know, people would talk if you had them before noon, so I thought I'd wait till for the evening meeting. And, a lot of us are transplanted Philadelphians. I was happening to think when you're commenting about the Yankees. You know, strictly speaking, if you take the classical definition of Yankee, and that's the Mason-Dixon line, if you extend that east to the ocean, in South Jersey, we're south of it. So, you know, I don't know. We're not really, Rationalization. Oh, God. I can rationalize anything. I did that for years as to whether I was an alcoholic or not. So we're south of the Mason-Dixon line. We got out of Philly. I just wanted to say it's an honor to come here, and we want to thank Tom for inviting us. I don't know if he's arrived yet or not. I guess you fire a sponsor if he doesn't show up. Is that it? So thank you very, very much. It was a long drive, but I wish we could be instantly transplanted. We'd be here all the time. I want to say, okay, John said I'm at this Riverfront Prison. For those from Philly, the main bridge between downtown Philadelphia, there's lots of bridges to cross the Delaware River, but the main one between downtown Philly and downtown Camden is called the Ben Franklin, appropriately. And right at the base of that bridge is this maximum security prison, Riverfront State Prison, appropriately named Riverfront. It looks nice from the Philly side. If you ever go to one of the restaurants in the docks over there, it's quite impressive. But from the Camden side, it's not that very pretty, and nor is that area of Camden. But for me, it's been the best thing that's happened in my sobriety. And I know, taken from, I'm not sure what we were supposed to say here except your connection. So I had two thoughts. One I got last night where they said, where they had people up here sharing as to how you got started and do you know of any miracles. Let me save that till the end. And then, to say something about the meeting or the prison. So, you know, the particular meeting that's there. This one got started by my home group about 9 years ago, I guess before I was sober. My sobriety date, I was going to say that, is October 7th, 1986. I was a late bloomer. Long time in denial. This group started, it's not even part of H&I, so they routinely, you know, people just succeed and go over and take this commitment and bring speakers in. And The meeting, for me, when I finally got into it, okay, how did I get started? I got started, I guess, just simply by not saying no. It would be normal for someone to ask you when you're a member of that home group to go over and speak, and that was the one place I didn't want to do because I couldn't connect in any way. I couldn't imagine, you know, when you look at my socioeconomic upbringing and background and degrees, it's like I can't relate to these people, you know. And I thought they'd laugh me out of there. And so what did I do? You know, the temptation was to exaggerate the story, but there was no way I could convert mine into one in my sick mind that I thought they'd want to hear. So I just went over, I remember the first time, and I think I threw four or five F's in every sentence, and I thought that would maybe, you know, maybe make me fit in. I doubt that it did, because now that I've been there on the other side, not going in as a speaker, I realized that what they're interested in is recovery. And because they've told me that, you know, you can't top their war story, so it doesn't matter that yours sounds a little bit like, you know, paint drying on the wall. That's the way my image was of what I had. But for me, it was the worst. You know, it got me here. I didn't want to go on living. So I went there, and I did that, and three or four times, maybe every 6 months, and I didn't know that the story ever got any better, but I got more comfortable going there. And finally, this opportunity to go and bring the meeting in to get speakers came, and I didn't want to do that unless there was a second person because I couldn't stand the thought that I wouldn't show up or was out of town on business or vacation and there wouldn't be a meeting. So we got a second guy, and 1 month in, and he dropped out. So now I've had it alone, and you know, and it works out. He takes care of us. I've had it almost for 2 years now. And one of the frustrating things we were supposed to talk about, is it like a group or a meeting? It's really a meeting. We have someone there open it up, and someone reads, preamble, et cetera, how it works. And one of the inmates is a chairman. But one of the things I found most frustrating about it in the beginning was that it was hard. Years ago, you could get a speaker in by just phoning in his name the night before an address. And I guess they did a quick search, much like you'd get if you got stopped for drunk driving or what, you know, whatever they run through the computer. But now you have this form to fill out. And with all your criminal record, et cetera, like that, and they run it through a couple agencies. Well, I was starting to get those filled out, but they were taking 2, 3, 5, 6 months, you know, and it was like... It was driving me crazy, and because I was afraid of failing, this fear of I couldn't get a speaker to come in, and yet I was thought I was doing my part. And I guess what I got out of it is that the realization that AA has no God-given or constitutional rights to be in prison. I mean, we're there as their guests. I mean, I wanted to go in and wring their necks. I mean, it was like, I understand, you know, government bureaucracy in the state, because before it was so much simpler when you could just call in the name. Now with these forms, they got layers of people. I'm sure it created a couple of new jobs to go get these papers, and they write memos to each other, and they circulate them, and it goes all the way up to some place, and then all the way down, and I'm sure it gets lost somewhere. So it was very frustrating. But what I did was beat the system. What I did was just get so many people signed up that I inundated them with paperwork and then gently bugged them, and now I've got, I'm so far ahead that it doesn't matter that sometimes it takes 3 or 4 months to get one cleared. So that was my way around it. But I, as I said, I know that I can't go in there and, you know, we're AA, and you better get these things through your system. It doesn't work that way. Just let me share one or two experiences there. As I say, maybe it's connected with what Robbie was saying last night about involvement versus commitment. I think I was always pretty involved with AA from the beginning. But nothing has done as much for me as this commitment. And for a guy that couldn't relate, that felt he had nothing in common, I didn't recognize our disease that was in common, with these guys, it's become the best thing for me ever in sobriety. I mean, it's the highlight of my week to go there on Wednesday night. Why? Let me just give you an example of one person. You know, I was thinking last night when the chairman said, you know, share how you got started, which I just did, and then any miracles. And I thought, you know, I don't have any miracles to tell you about them. Because I can tell you 3 or 4 sad stories of people that got out and went out again, of guys that I know, one in particular that OD'd on insulin. And that's a long story, and I won't go into it, but we had become good friends, and his sister came in to, he went into a coma for 4 or 5 months, and she had to pull the plug and found my name in his room, the only one there, because we used to write, and we had a long talk. Turns out she's from San Diego and is in the program, and she goes to prison meetings, and it's really a neat story. But if you think, is that a miracle? I mean, he isn't with us today. Well, you know, I'm still here. It helped me. My bottom line on that was that Frank just didn't know how to ask for help. Just too proud. But there's a guy in there now that's been in there 31 years that to me is really a magnificent story. And this is what I get out of it. How does someone in that setting that's total negativity, surrounded by booze and drugs, almost impossible to get 1 second a day alone in quiet. How does someone like that stay sober? Because I want to know. You know, I think I have bad days. And while there may not be many, there are some in there that do for long periods of time in an environment of for a lot that's almost hopelessness. I know a lot get out, but some, like this particular guy, will probably never get out just because of the nature, not so much of his crime, but who he did it to. And he's still sober. And what it comes down to is service, because what he did was get an education, someone sitting right here got an education, got a college degree. Is a psychologist, and he counsels many of the prisoners on alcoholism, and he works with the worst of the worst in a way. There's a ward there they call the Fruit and Nut Ward, and he actually lives in there. He's the only one that has a single cell because they let him have his books for a library. Most others are 2 or 3 in a cell, and that's what he does. There's some guards that come to him for counseling. Despite the hopelessness, you know, stays sober. As I see it, one heart touching another. You know, service to others, because otherwise, why would you do it? I know I asked myself that question. This is the slow suicide for those who can't do it. The drinking, I'm talking about, for those who can't, you know, jump off the bridge type thing or slash your wrist. So, why should I stay sober if there isn't something in my life that's worthwhile? That there's something to look forward to, and yet here's an example of a guy that did. And one last experience, the same guy, with all that, a terrible thing happened in his life just recently, that his mother died right around Christmas. Well, the week before, we go in on a Wednesday, I think Christmas went on a Sunday, he told me that she was terminally sick and was very, very upset. And then the week after, he told me that she had died, and he was really, really, really upset. And the thing that upset him the most, and this is really something to think about when you think about that first drink, or the first fatal drink, as we call it, because that's really the bottom line. That's what caused this. Was not that his mom died, and not that his mom died at Christmas. That's very, very traumatic. But the thing that broke this guy up the absolute most was that he couldn't go to the funeral. He had to be there. That's what hurt the most. And we all know, and he knew it too, that it was the first drink that had him there. So it's a very, very powerful message for me to remember. And you know, that is the miracle. I couldn't tell you any great stories, the miracle stories of guys that got out in my personal experience. But when you think about it, the miracle there is that that guy's still sober for 31 years. Thanks.
Thank you, Joe. Next, we have Charlie S. And Charlie is from our Cape Atlantic Intergroup, and he is the Cape Atlantic Hospitals and Institutions chairperson. And he is also the Cape May City Prison Chair. Charlie.
Hello, my name's Charlie. I'm an alcoholic. My home group is Seattle Saturday Night. That's in New Jersey. I want to thank you for having invited us up here. It was a long drive. I'll tell you a little bit. It's the Cape May County Jail. It's an institution. It holds about 200 inmates. Most of them are there for anywhere from 30 days. To 2 years, I think, is the maximum there. They've been getting an overflow from the prisons. I got involved in speaking at the jail due to a good friend of mine who had been doing it, also coaches kids in the summer. And in the summer, he needed some help. And I said, look, I'll fill out an application. He said, you don't have any wants or warrants on you, do you? I said, as far as I know, I'm all right. And I filled it out, and I was a little nervous, but I did get cleared, and I went in there the first time, and I was a little, I can't say I was scared, but I just really didn't know what to expect. And you go in, and they close this door, and it's where they also have the church meeting. So there's pews, and then in front of the pews is a table with a couple chairs there. And I sat in front of these guys, and they're all in greens, green fatigues. And I'm looking out at these guys, and I'm thinking to myself, but for the grace of God, I'm on this side and not sitting out there with them. And I shared my experience, strength, and hope with them. And there were some guys talking to themselves over there, and some guys over here is half asleep. And I thought, well, this is what it's about. But there was a few guys in the front that were really paying attention. And at the end of the meeting, or at the end of my sharing, I asked them if anybody had anything they wanted to talk about. And one guy raised his hand and asked me some things about my story, and then another guy shared, and there was about a half a dozen guys share. Well, that was the first Friday night, and then he said, will you come back next week? I said, all right. And then next thing you know, that whole summer, every Friday night I did it. The winter time was coming, and Friday night I was on a bowling league, and the captain of my team asked me, he goes, are you going to bowl this year? And I was thinking, do I want to bowl or go to this jail meeting? I'm bowl jail. And I said, well, I'm going to do the jail this winter and try it. So I did that jail all that winter. A lot of guys that had been cleared to come in and speak either would find different excuses why they couldn't make it. Once in a while they would show. Once in a while they would not show. But I stuck with it, and I committed myself to doing that meeting. And between me and the guy that got me involved, there has always been a meeting there in the last 4.5 years that have been guaranteed. We haven't missed for one reason or another. If he can't make it, he calls me. If I can't make it, I call him. But when I say I'm going to do it, I usually we try to take a month or 2 month commitment. In that time, in the last 2 years, we've been passing out applications left and right, trying to get people cleared to come in. And it doesn't take as long in our county jail to get cleared. But to get guys to come on a regular basis, to commit to coming regularly, is tough. Maybe they just don't get as much out of it as I do. It's the one part of service. I'm very involved in service. I love service. It's kept me sober. My sponsor tells me it's the backbone to AA. And like I said, speaking into jail, for me personally, I get the most out of that part of service. I love doing it. Trying to get the guys involved to speak and share their experience is tough because I think they're worried about what the other guy in the jail is going to say. But every now and then they start to open up, and when they start to open up, it just a good feeling comes over me, and I can see that they're starting to understand a little bit about it. Every now and then you get a guy who'll come up to you after the meeting and say thanks for coming. And to me, that makes me feel great, you know. And every now and then, a guy will be asleep, and I'll say, I don't care if you come here to sleep. The guys that are here to listen, they know who they are, and they'll come up to me after the meeting and says, "Don't listen to what those guys say. You keep coming back. We need you here," and that makes me feel good. We have a lot of great cooperation with the warden. With the guards there, they're wonderful. When I come, they know me now. Most of the time they say, "Hi, Charlie," you know, and they look in my box. I bring in literature. At my home group, I make announcement every Saturday night that we need help with literature. My new thing is I moved the lip service can, from the back of the meeting up to the front next to the coffee pot. So when they come to get coffee, they see it there. And I sit by that coffee pot, and I give them a look, and I see the guy reach in, and he drops some change in there. So that's worked out rather well. Sometimes I know guys think I'm a real pain because I'm constantly pushing for this cooperation and for these literature for the meeting, but it works. And you know, every time I go, I have a full box of Grapevines and AA books, and it works. And when I give them out, I don't know if they're going to read them or not, but they come back, and what I try to tell the guys in there is, I say, if you try to get some of this program while you're in here, when you get out, you try to get to a meeting, and you'll have a good chance of staying out. And that's my message to the prisoners. That's what I try to deliver. We just started something new down there where we're getting phone numbers of all the different areas, and when a guy's getting ready to get released, we give him a phone contact, and that phone contact will be somebody that will take him to a meeting, or at least arrange for them to get to a meeting. The miracles of the program that I've seen, I've seen a lot of guys, especially, like I say, it's a short-term jail. I've seen a lot of guys leave and come back a month later, and I say, "Well, you must really love the meetings in here to keep coming back." But maybe it's my message they want to come back in here. I don't know. But they do keep coming back, and that's the sad part of it. But the miracle of it is, I'll say to these guys, what's the first thing you're going to do when you get out of here? And the guys will start saying, "I'm going to see my girlfriend. I'm going to go get a bag. I can't wait to get to the bar." And one guy will say, "Well, I think I'm going to call the number you gave me." And to me, that's what it's all about. One guy in a few years is what it's all about. Just to know that it's not falling on deaf ears. When I see other people committed to coming in on a regular basis to speak, you know, when I see the people come up and give me a big book, you know, a couple times a year they buy big books and I know who they are, and I just say, "Thank you very much. It's appreciated." That's the part of my heart that I know it's working. And when I come to something like this and see so many people involved, you know, and caring, and I never had to do any long term in the joint. I never, you know, I always had enough money to have lawyers, because it's not that I didn't do any crimes. Believe me, I was, you know, I was not an angel, but I was fortunate enough where I had money. I never got caught. That's probably the biggest thing. I didn't get caught. Most of the charges that I did get in trouble for were misdemeanor, drunk and disorderly. But the insanity of the alcohol was, I was capable of doing anything they did, or not worse. So when guys say, "Aren't you scared to go in there?" I said, "No, they're the people I hung with. You know, they're the kind of guys were my buddies." I said, "For me, the grace of God, I'm able to leave after that hour and a half. I can walk out. And when I walk out and the gate's closed behind me, I always say a little prayer to thank God and keep giving me the strength to keep coming back here." and keep me sober that I can keep bringing my message into this place. And I know I'm probably going to get beat, but I want to keep talking till they kind of like tap me. The other part of this program that I just want to say is that the more people that I can get involved in it, the longer I know it'll keep going on. And I do want to say thanks again, and I want to thank Tom. He came to Jersey and delivered a dynamite message that was real powerful, and I've been passing his tape around to all my buddies. So thank you very much.
I'm not going to let them fire me. This, you know, I just get too much from this. Thanks for letting me be here. When I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I had been given I was under indictment for grand jury, and through the grace of God, I was entered into a program, a pre-trial intervention. A gentleman in AA came and gave me a character witness, and I was still drinking at the time, but you know, through the grace of God, I didn't have to go to jail. So when this commitment came up, I thought, well, maybe there's something I need to give back here. Prior to that, I was arrested 4 times the month before I went into rehab. All through my life, I was getting arrested. I kept moving around. My parents kept moving me out of town, and my husbands kept moving me out of town, and these people just kept finding me, and I kept drinking and drugging. Every time it was with alcohol, I found trouble, or trouble found me, you know. I haven't been arrested in 10 years, you know, and that's a miracle. That is a miracle. And I'm celebrating my 10 years with you folks this week, you know, this month, so. Yeah. It's amazing. It's amazing. So I feel like this is my gift, my AA gift, you know, letting me come down here. I do the women's minimum security work release program up in Burlington County. We do, I should say. When I first started out, there were two ladies that were going every Tuesday, and I said, well, I like to go on this commitment. You know, I know about getting arrested. So let me see what I can do here. So I went up, and the lady called me the next day. She said, Carol, you're our new coordinator. I said, well, if I need help, can I call you? She said, do not call me. So along I went, you know, being the control freak I am, I went and I got a schedule, and I wrote up a list of suggestions that we could bring into the prison. And I joined a woman's group, and I said, well, I need somebody to back me up here. And I became very persuasive with them. The girls say, well, I never got arrested. Well, you never got caught, and that is the main thing. You know, these girls got caught, and maybe we didn't, you know. And so we go up, and it's been 9 years that I've had this commitment. And I just go up there, and I tell the ladies that come in with us that, you know, you can't bullshit a bullshitter, because that is the message my sponsor gave me, you know. Because after he did the character witness and I got off of all these charges, 4 years later I invited him to lunch and told him, I have to tell you, I did those things. He said, I knew that. You can't bullshit a bullshitter. So, you know, I carried this guilt around for 4 years. And, Jesus, you know. So anyway, you know, I just go in there and we have a wonderful rapport with the warden. It took 9 years, you know, to get to this. They take us out to breakfast. They prepare dinner for us once a year. And the inmates serve us. We take in softback books, and we have raffle tickets, and the girls look forward to that. At the end of the meeting, we raffle off the ticket. I get the inmates to read how it works and the preamble. It's you know, they only do up to a day less than a year there because they're waiting to be resentenced or for whatever. So it's like a little hard for me to organize a whole meeting with chair people and stuff there. But I get them to share. You know, when they're a little rowdy, I say, okay, it's your turn to share, because it's very hard for us to sit up here. And I try to get them involved in that. They give out the tickets. They pull the tickets out. You know, all those little things just that made me feel involved when they would let me make coffee or something, you know. They want to get me a cup of coffee. I tell you, the first time I walked in there and they shut that door behind me, I was scared to death. These ladies had their foot up on the chair and a cigarette hanging out of their mouth, and I was scared to death. But I knew I belonged there, or I could belong there, I should say. And, you know, now I hug them. To see these women that are so hardened by the alcohol and drugs is, they cry now, you know, they talk to me. We, inside our softback books that we raffle off, we write the name and the address of our women's meeting on Saturday evening in Morristown, New Jersey. I constantly tell them, that's where you go when you get out of here. You know, we can all stop drinking and drugging, but, you know, how are you going to stay stopped? We have wonderful meetings up there. And the support of the warden and all the officers is just amazing. But it took time. You know, we are their guests there, and I have to go by their rules. And I try to drill that into the heads of the women that come with me. You know, we have to go by their rules. And Alcoholics Anonymous taught me how to be a lady and be respectful, you know, and to keep my mouth shut sometimes and listen. And that's what I have to do. I have to look them in the eye, and I represent the big book when I go up there. So I have to act accordingly. We have a lot of tears, we have a lot of laughter, and it's just been a great commitment. You know, I go to home groups and I beg literature and I beg books, and I'm not above doing that, you know. But it keeps us going, you know. Of course, we can't pass a basket. We've had problems from time to time with girls calling our homes and stuff at all hours of the morning, calling collect, and so now we just give the Alcoholics Anonymous intergroup phone number, and we tell them where to go on Saturday evenings when they get out. The first thing you do is make a meeting, you know. We have a couple girls who have celebrated some time, and you know, just from coming into the prison, you know. I walk in and I feel like they're my girlfriends. They say, "Hey, girlfriend," you know, and I hug them, you know, and. We talk about all kinds of things, you know, but the main thing is if you don't drink, you don't get drunk, you know. I try to keep it real simple and real basic. And, you know, some of them come out and get some time together. But they say, "Carol, you tell us to keep coming back," but I said, "I don't mean here, you know, I don't mean here." But, you know, the women in the program have just been dynamite, absolutely dynamite. We have like 16 women that have been going up this whole year, and, you know, coming out here this weekend is, I'm getting a little more enthusiastic again. You know, I was thinking, oh, maybe I should give this commitment up. But every time I feel that way, something great happens, you know, and I go up and have a meeting. And, you know, it's just like one day at a time, and I'm not there to tell them what to do. I'm just here to tell them that there is another way. It doesn't have to be that way, you know. Because I can relate to everything that they're in there for, every single thing, you know. And trying to break down that denial, that's what slaps me in the face every time I walk in that door, you know. It may have been enough for me, but maybe it's not enough for them. But if they keep coming back and, you know, allow me to come in and, you know, it keeps me sober. And for that, I'm so grateful. That's all I got. Thank you.
Hi, everybody. I'm Steve, and I'm definitely an alcoholic. And I'm only sober today through the grace of God and you people, man. I have not a problem saying that today. For so long, when I first came into the rooms, I said, "You can begin, I'm here." You know, and and it took me a long while before I realized that maybe I ought to step aside, because I am no longer the coordinator of the universe. It's somebody else. So that job's open if anybody has that qualification. I look around and I don't have my court suit, and I feel like drastically underdressed here, but it doesn't fit any longer because I no longer have to eat that bowl of oatmeal. I no longer have to eat that piece of cornbread that's 5 weeks old, you know, and that's only through the grace of God, man. I am so grateful to be here. You just can't imagine. I am the chairperson of the H&I in South Jersey, and what we do is, there's a couple of these pamphlets in the back, and we have our H&I meetings once a month where we distribute commitments for all the institutions, the hospitals, the rehabs, and the prisons, who otherwise will not get that message unless we take it to them. And you know, for me to be in this position, you know, it's only because of people like yourselves that I'm here today. Because if it wasn't for hospitals and institutions bringing that message to me, there's not, I wouldn't have had a chance in the world to be in here today. And you people giving me that relationship with God, which, the Lord knows, man, I did not want. You know, I fought it all the way. All the way, you know. My scorecard read zero, and I was finally just seeing 1-0, you know. I straightened out enough to figure out that I was the problem. And they say that God speaks through people. And, you know, I got my first prison commitment August 21st in 1991 when the judge told me I was a thorn in the side of society. And that was my first commitment. He says, I'm committing you to the New Jersey State penal system. And, you know, from that point on, that was the greatest day of my life, I need to tell you. You know, I am so grateful for that man saying, it's time for you to, like, get off the streets, you know. And then I had to call my family up. And, well, actually, my daughter, she was the only one I had some concern for. And she told me she hated me and never wanted to see me again. And I was devastated. Devastated. You know, because her so successful father, once again, is calling her from an institution saying, well, you can come talk to me through the windows again. You know what I mean? And that's truly a heartbreaking. For the first time in my life, it was gut-wrenching that I was in there. So, you know, for me to be in this position and just to give this little bit back that I can, that you people have given me, God has truly blessed me today. We book 158 meetings through our H&I service, of which 84 of them go into the correctional facilities. And that's incredible to me. That's absolutely incredible. And it's a God's gift. God's gift, man. It is truly, you know, like everybody's saying, if we can reach one person, man, one person, you know, because so many of us are called and so few of us are chosen, you know. But my purpose today is to spread this message, you know, carry that message, you know. And by doing that, I stay sober. You know, for so long, I was the message, you know. I was the message, you know. I kept a lot of people sober, I need to tell you, you know. Because I would come crawling back in with my tail between my legs and said, it's no better, you know, it's no better. My jail sentences started increasing. My time on the streets started decreasing. You know, I'm so grateful. We go to one federal prison. We go to five state facilities. We go to one state halfway house. We have another federal prison we're waiting to get clearance to go into. We're in two juvenile facilities. You know, I had the pleasure of hosting a juvenile facility for a year. And I mean to tell you, the gratitude you get when one of them kids comes up to you and wants to hug and says, can I have your phone number? My God, when I was that age, I wouldn't want your phone number. I wouldn't want a damn thing to do with you. You know, your checkbook, yes, but not your phone number, you know. But, you know, I'm truly grateful today. You know, we have this disclaimer card that we read when we go into all these institutions, or at least I hope we read when we go into these institutions. It says, we feel it's important to remind you that individual AA members speak here as amateurs. We do not claim to be experts on the medical, physiological, or psychological aspects of alcoholism. We try to give answers as a practical matter based on our own personal experience. Each member who speaks here wants you to know that he or she does not nor cannot speak for AA as a whole. Our primary purpose in being here tonight is to help ourselves and offer a chance at sobriety to someone who may want it, you know, and that's so powerful. It is so powerful, you know, just to, speaking for myself, just to be able to go in there, want to go in there and share just what happened to me, you know, just share that there is hope for another day, just hope for another day, you know. You know, I thought I had a job with the state of New Jersey testing the food in these county jails for so long, you know. you know, coming up here, we were just sharing today, you know, I wasn't being extradited. It wasn't nothing. It was just a voluntary thing, you know. It's amazing. It's truly amazing, you know. Like, my resume is so good. It's incredible, you know. I think I'm the only one in South Jersey who's ever been thrown out of a homeless shelter, you know. But you know what? Today I look at all the craziness that went on. My past is my greatest asset today because I would not be here. I would not be here if I didn't go through everything I did. You know, I do not hold on to too much of that guilt. You know, I do hold on to some where my family members are involved, but I'm getting better at that. You know, I'm getting better at that. You know, so, you know, it's just, you know, these people here and all of you coming to share that message of hope with me, you know, and today I know that God has blessed me. He finally took that cotton out of my ears. I didn't do it. God did it, stuffed it in my mouth. And he did it through the mouth of that girl who hated me and never wanted to see me again. You know, and that girl wants to live with me today. And it's pretty powerful. It's pretty powerful. And, there's hope. You know, there's absolutely hope, you know. And I don't know. 2 years ago, Sister Maurice was at our convention, South Jersey, and she said some words that it was just amazing grace, how sweet to sound. Saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now I'm found. I'm blind, but now I can see, man. Thanks a lot.
My name's Herb. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Herb.
I get so full of emotion up here that where I came from just blows my socks off that I'm even here, you know. I'm glad to be anywhere, you know what I mean? And for me, I've heard a lot of things here, you know, and but for the grace of God, I'm staying here sober today, and I never had it so good, you know. And I hear these stories, and I just, each one of these people, you know, we've been these last few hours, 15 hours, 16 hours driving here, whatever it was, I can't, but, you know, talking about the oatmeal and four slices of bread, you know, that we used to get when we were in places and stuff like that, you know, and we stopped for lunch yesterday. We had I had black eyed peas myself with the rice and stuff, and I remember sitting in the Baltimore City Jail, and that's the first time I came in contact with the black eyed peas, you know. But for me, I was in prison in 1963 in Trenton State Prison, and it's it should have been condemned then. It was so old then, and I don't know if it's still functional or not, you know. I haven't been back to Trenton, you know, and but for the grace of God. And something happened to me when I went into that prison. I seen that electric chair. They brought me through there with the jewelry on, you know, the handcuffs and the chains around the waist and stuff when they transported me from Baltimore City Jail. And scared the hell out of me, you know. But that's the only thing it did. It just scared me, you know. And see, I never knew my problem was alcohol. And today I know alcohol is my enemy. And I go back to these. I don't want to go back to these places to carry this message, you know. And they told me when I first came around, you know, you got to carry the message to the new guy, you know. And that's the only insurance we have of staying sober for me, for this alcoholic. And I know that today. But and see, I never heard the message. I don't know whether they had the message in the prisons then or not. But I've seen the people that were coming back from this place they called the Broom Building. Walking zombies, loaded up on Thorazine, and shock treatments. And I said, man, them guys really must have had some bad ideas in their head, you know, because they're trying to zap them out with electricity, you know. And thank God it wasn't me. You know, they send me to them shrinks and stuff, and they show me ink blotters and stuff. And I said, man, these people are nuts, you know. I mean, what the hell's my craziness got to do with ink blotters and stuff, you know. But thank God I didn't pull a long bit, you know, and I got out of there, and but I never heard the message. You know, I never knew alcohol was my problem. You know, I didn't find out alcohol was my problem until 1989. And I heard a guy share here last night, you know, that was the best thing that ever happened to me, man, that I found out I was a drunk and an alcoholic. I knew I was a drunk, but I didn't know I had a fatal illness, you know, and because I couldn't stop drinking. See, drinking led me to the world of, you know, sex, rock and roll, and drugs, and the whole nine yards, you know. I had no clue that you were supposed, what people were supposed to live like normal. I, from the very first beginning, man, from when I shined shoes in bars at 11 years old, that was my world, you know. And but today it's different, you know. I thank God that he's gave me the opportunity to go into a prison and try and carry this message, you know. And what freaks me out the most when I go into these places, I don't carry, I'm not carrying, I get the message, man. And it got my sponsor told me early on, you know, he says, you go to the jails, to the detox, and to the institutions and carry this message, you know, you're going to see yourself time and time again, you know. And when I relate back to the, you know, the people that I see in there, I walked into a place a couple of weeks ago, and the guy was burnt severely, face, you know, you couldn't even recognize him. I mean, you couldn't even look at him, that's how bad it was, you know. And it was like staring in my own eyes because of them fires. You know, when I used to pass out and wake up in the middle of the night, crawl out of, on my hands and knees, you know, from where I fell asleep with a cigarette and stuff, you know. But for the grace of God, there go I, you know. And this Bayside prison, you know, I've only been going there maybe about 6 months or so. And I was in Bayside. I was in the minimum security, you know, at the farm after they sent me from Trenton. And I'm walking out of there, you know, I seen this guy for a while, you know, and every time I go there to this meeting, you know, and he was, you know, I didn't really get to talk to him that much, but we're walking out of there about 2 weeks ago, and he's walking alongside him, and I said, he told me he was getting out, you know, on June 8th, and I said, well, how much time did you do? He said, didn't you see my number? And that's how they go. You can tell by how long they've been in there, you know, by their number. But I you know, it was so long ago since I was in there. But anyway, he said, oh, I've been in here since 1970, 24 years, you know. It shocked me, you know, rocked me right on my feet, you know. And I said, my God, 24 years. I was in, and then I'm trying to calculate. I was in there in 63, and he came in there in 70, you know. And I think how long I've been on the streets, you know, like a raving maniac. And but for the grace of God, there was I again, you know. And but anyway, this guy, something happened, he didn't get out. And but, you know, to go in there and carry the message, like they said, you know, if you can only help, if you can just help one person, man, it's worth it to me. And there's no better insurance than carrying this message to those who still suffer. And that's what kept me coming back, you know. I got the hope in these rooms, you know, when I first came around. When I found out, like I said, when I found out I was an alcoholic, man, I had that total relief over me, you know, and I just can't talk no more. Thanks for letting me share.
Hey everybody, my name is John. I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank you all for having us, and this is the greatest honor of my life. Earlier, John was talking about, you know, being born in the same hospitals and all, and it reminded me of a story. My ex-wife was having lunch with a co-worker of hers, and they were eating, and they discovered that they both had the same birth date. And I said, oh, yeah, you're the same birth. And she said, yeah, where were you born? She said, Philadelphia. She said, so was I. And she said, what hospital were you born in? And she said, Jefferson Hospital. She said, so was I. And the girl said, I was born with a veil. And she said, well, that's probably why I didn't recognize you. I had a, when he said that story, reminded me of that. Has no relation to anything. But and Charlie, Irv was talking about, you know, I did 17 years in prisons, and not all at once, but, you know, like I said last night, life on the installment plan. You know, I had a few years here, a few years, but I was always in jail, and like Carol said, I was always in trouble. I was always getting arrested. I was always in chains. I was always in parole offices and courts and bail bondsmen and all that, you know, insanity. And I used to get analyzed a lot, try to figure me out, you know. And I remember they showed me them blotters. And I thought, I wonder why they show me all these dirty pictures. couldn't figure it out. But my first sponsor was a man who was, he died last year or a year before, or I have no concept of time, you know, I put it out of my mind in jail. And his name was Tom Goldie, God bless his soul. He had 36 years when he died. And he said to me, he said, John, he said, a lot of guys are going to listen to you that wouldn't listen to nobody else. So when I got the opportunity to go in these prisons, you know, I firmly believe in my heart and soul that this is the reason that I'm alive today. Because God wants me to carry this message into the prisons. So I really don't have much to say about the structure and of these groups and all, and how they formulate them and all, and operate them in jail. I'll leave that to Ginger. She's the expert on that. You know, she's the one responsible for getting me into these prisons. I remember the first time she said, "You want to go to jail?" I said, "No." She said, "Well, they'll let you back out again tonight." I said, "You sure?" She said, "Yeah." I said, "All right, I'll go." But it was the best thing that ever happened to me, you know. And I tell in my story how I was out on 15 bails at one time. I was out on 15 bails, all felonies. I was out like on $500,000 in bails. And I called my lawyer from San Juan, Puerto Rico. I says, "Oh, Joe," I said, "this is Jack." He said, where are you at? I said, "I'm in San Juan, Puerto Rico." He said, "What are you, crazy? Don't you know you got to go to court tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock? I said, "Joe, that's why I'm in San Juan, Puerto Rico." I said, "If I'm going to jail, let them come and get me. I'm not going to turn myself in." He said, "No, I'm going to get you a postponement." I said, "Are you sure?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "Okay." So I flew up to Newark and I rented a car and I sped down the turnpike and I walked in the courtroom or the city hall and I ran into him on the first floor and I said, "Here," and I gave him $1,000, 10 $100 bills for this postponement. You know, this was the going rate. So he says, "All right, go up to room 656 and wait for me. I got to take care of this matter down here." I said, "Okay." So I went up and make a long story short, that when they called my name out, he wasn't there, and I'm walking down the aisle, and I figured the judge is going to say, "All right, sit down till your lawyer gets here." And the judge looks down, he says, "You stand committed. All your bails are revoked." And I said, "What, without me even having a lawyer?" He said, "That's right, I'm tired of your fancy footwork in and out of these courts." So now, they got me in the cell room, and I had a bundle of heroin in my pocket, and I made the newspapers again, more insanity, you know. And he comes up and he said, "What happened?" I said, "What happened?" I said, "Where were you, Joe?" I said, "Joe, I can go to jail for free. I don't have to give you $1,000 to go to jail." So, make a long story short, they wanted to go to trial on 15 cases. So, they had 11 that they were prepared to go to trial on. And they offered me a deal of 10 years. And I said, 10 years? I said, "No. I ain't turning no 10 years. But then when I started, they found me guilty on two real quick, and I could see that they're going to find me guilty on all of them. So I said, "Talk to that man, you know, see what kind of deal you can get." So he came back and he said, "John," he said, "if you persist in this madness, he's going to give you 20 to 40. I said, "20 to 40? I said, "Take the 10. So, you know, 10 don't seem so bad when you're talking 40, you know. So make a long story short, I'm up at the detention center, and I thought, 10 years, I gotta write this judge a letter, you know. And so I wrote him a letter, and I said, "Look, I understand that we made a deal, but I got to do something." I said, "I figured if I could make you see what it was really like for me out there, you'd have to give me a break. You know, you'd have to give me a break." So I said, "Now, I don't know whether I was successful in my other letters." So what I did is I wrote a sort of a poem. I said, it goes like this. And this is the message that I give to these guys in the joint. I said, "Listen, my addiction is like an affliction that's similar to, at the very best, leprosy and cancer, and the more vile of all the rest, because when this filthy hand is on you, contaminated you become, and the lowest form of life on earth, and you become as one. Your feelings like you've known them immediately cease to be, because it transforms you into a corpse that from life is not quite free. And every day thereafter will come a dread that you won't live. And yet, deep inside, you hear this cry, 'Please, death, my freedom give.' Persistently you search and you search for what you feel will never, ever be. Still you pray every day, 'Please, God, from this bondage set me free. Freedom from bondage. And this is the message that I take to these guys. There's another way. See, I always believed that there was only two ways. You were either a cop or a robber. And I was a robber, you know. And once I got down that lane, there was no turning back, you know. So I didn't know that there was a third alternative, which is this life that I'm involved in today, Alcoholics Anonymous. This is fantastic. I mean, I have never, I got one I never, and that's I never had it so good. I feel for the first time in my life, I feel like I belong. I never felt like I belong. I feel like I'm worthy today. I feel like a man today. I always wanted to be a man, but I thought a man was like John Wayne, you know, who could drink two-fisted and fight the most guys. And I thought I got all these, you know. You might have thought I'd join a knitting club or something, but I used to think I was Zorro, you know. But, and I never won. And when I went into rehab, I didn't have no teeth in my mouth. I weighed 130 pounds, and I thought I was going to die in the gutter. And I was convinced of it. And God, like, said, well, all right, I guess he's had enough now. It's like, you know, in rehab, and they rehab a house. They take that house, and they gut it, completely gut it, and then they rebuild it. And it's better than original. And that's what God is starting to do with me. And the 12 steps, I'm trying as best I can. I'm not real good at it real yet, but I'm working at it. And thank God it's progress and not perfection, because I do make a lot of mistakes, but he's real forgiving, my higher power. And I just want to thank you all for having me here. Thank you very much.
You're going to need those. You'll need them on the way home. I'm Ginger. I'm an alcoholic. And I love thugs. I've always loved thugs. I learned how to do things like rob banks, blow up buildings, carry nitro. And I'm a professional with 36 master's credits who couldn't read when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, you have given me the ability to read. And Virginia, I loved, and I saw you get up there last night. It's like, I have to learn from these women and go up and politely do it and take charge. I just steamroll her and I go in there, you know. So I wasn't ready for CPC when I came here, believe me. The only thing I knew how to say was MF. And when they gave me this position a couple of years ago, I didn't even scratch my head. I just, like, you got to be blanking kidding, you know, because you have to talk to these people. I have to sit down. And you know, somebody had to tell me, you know what, Ginger? You're a professional. You do this every day. And I have difficulty perceiving myself. That's why I have a sponsor. That's why I have a home group. And in my case, I have a home county. I don't know what you guys have. I wasn't accepted for, how can I say, the truth. I asked 9 people to be my sponsor. They said no. They were a little too healthy. There weren't that many women in Alcoholics Anonymous. I come from a rodeo town. I'm not a Philadelphia bred. I'm a New York bred. And I kept running souther and souther because I got freer and freer. And I figured you couldn't hear the guns go off. And in the house I bought, you still can't hear the guns go off, you know, and there used to be nothing but, and well, there still isn't anything but horses and cows live near me. You know, there's one house and he's as loud as I am, you know, so it doesn't make any difference. And I didn't want the police to come every time a gun went off. And I didn't want the police to come every time there was another car with blood dripping from it. Or at 2 o'clock in the morning, we're just coming in, and then we go out on a run at 5, and we're, you know, the madness. You know what I mean? They told me that I would not get rid of my character defects. They were right. That I would be able to turn them into my assets, and that I would be able to take. There's never anything wrong with love. Never. It's how we pervert it, you know. And I still love thugs. You know, you're near and dear to my heart. And there are women thugs. I'm one of them. You know, I'm little, but I'm tough. Ask them. I think AA as such will never be organized. And I love it. He says, I'm the one that does structure. I'm the most disorganized one in this entire group. Yet they give me the job to organize. You know, it's a riot. I think half of our treasurers were thieves.
Do you know what I mean? They knew how to take it out, but now they put it back in. I mean, they all came to my house for breakfast before we got here, so they can tell you I'm telling the truth. You know, but their breakfast was organized. Don't go anyplace else in the house. I mean, you can go anywhere you want, but you might not be able to find your way back. Yeah. You know? Okay. That's the basics, okay? At 6 months sober, I was sponsored by people who said they wouldn't sponsor me, okay? And she said, you just keep looking. You need somebody more like you. I had pursued this professional career, but when I came into AA, I had 5 personalities. I did very well when by the time I got down to 3, I thought I was really doing something. See, I used Muhammad because I didn't understand him. And when I got to jail, the guys gave me Muhammad. And Muhammad prayed for me. They asked him to pray for me. And eventually, the big book says you'll go back to the religion of your youth. Most of us do, it says. And when I got down to 3 personalities, I knew I had the Trinity. And I walked into a priest and said, can you throw me out of church if I tell you that the reason I'm here is that there's one God for each of my personalities? He said, sounds good to me. Now, you got to understand, coming from a Roman Catholic priest who has an Italian accent, who is brought up in Italy, I've never heard, sounds good to me. You know, it's usually redirect this, rechannel this. So God's been working along the lines of trying to make me understand how much he loves me. Every piece of the way. People did not sponsor me because I needed more. The people in my area who were sober, long-term, strong, service sobriety, were men. They were 38, 40, 45. And that was 8.5 years ago, okay? And some of them are deceased now. But I had the pleasure of having them come to my house for coffee on Saturday mornings. They come a distance. And they taught me that although I was new in sobriety, I had skills that could help them. You know, Robbie said last night that the guys with 60 days and 90 days were telling him, you can do it, kid, you can do it. Here's a 38-year guy sitting in my living room right after I learned to read, and I'm doing his checkbook for him. John has just got a checkbook. Always deal in cash. You run out of it, you go get more. No matter whose it is. You know, and it's taken me a long time to understand that logic. You know what I mean? I just never had any. You know, I've never been good with it. I gave it away. I bailed you out. And so my electric wasn't paid. Today, I know that's not how it works. I know that it's very important, especially with the concept of alcohol, that I fill up at meetings so that I have a message to carry. Steve is my great-great-grandchild, and you are my grandchild, okay? They are each holding positions that I held previously. I said, I don't want to leave corrections. They said, well, we'll go from, I went from co-chair to chairman and in intergroup and then general service, I went to chairman there. So for 5 years, I never had to leave the position. And I was practically tearing my hair out. And they said, well, we'll put you in CPC. I was gritting my teeth. And I did it. And I said, yes. And then I came up with the big idea. I said, okay, we're going to use this. We're going to go talk to wardens. And what I found out from NARASA, Northeast Regional Alcoholics Anonymous Service Assembly, is that's what we're supposed to be doing. The best part is if I can get into a warden before we go in and mess it up. Okay, because if I can get into a warden and let him see the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous, A, we are not here to take from you. We are here to give you and to be a resource for you. We have found by experience that people like me no longer have to say MF every word out of their mouth. That we become comfortable in our own skin, and therefore we're not here to take you out of yours. We're not as oversensitive as, and I still have my days where whoever's close to me is going to be the chopping block. But they're not even days, they're moments. You know, sometimes the moments are longer than others. Yeah, okay, routine. But that used to be me all the time. I came into AA and I stabbed 3 people in the throat. That was my first year of sobriety. I know about anger. I know about how they feel when they're not drinking. And I know you know that too. The hardest part for an alcoholic is to get from the not drink part into the part where we're okay with us. And when I'm okay with me, I'm okay with you. That's the steps. And in order for me to get to the steps with you in jail, or with these people to give you the steps, I need to get through to the professionals and to let them know that we're not here to take your job. We're not here to tell you what to do. We're not here to oversee you. We just need to know that we need a little anonymity. We need some time alone, if needed, to do a fourth and fifth step. We need a little bit of peace and a little cooperation. We need your phone number, and these are the things we have to give you. And we have a lot of things that we give. Major thing that everybody talked about is I have a phone number. I hated doing this. Talk about anonymity. I remember the guy before me that did this, and I thought, what a sucker. Man, what an ego. You know what professionals do? They trade cards. You know? And now I'm in this dungaree and sweatshirt woman is hanging out here in a dress exchanging my card. You know? You're supposed to leave a card so he can put it on his desk and call you. You know? It's an interesting change, and the metamorphosis has taken place in all of us. On this card is not just my number, because I believe in the we, and because my inner group and my sponsor helps put me together, and so does General Service John here. We have the inner group telephone numbers, all three of them. So whichever local area that you're closest at, you can make the appropriate phone call, and they'll get in touch with either their CPC PI person or me, and we'll redirect until we get it together. One of the other things that I have that's available that I bring and let them know a list of things is I always bring a catalog from New York. And the telephone number or the fax number so they can call New York to supply their prison. I've got to tell you honestly, that generally doesn't happen. We have an inmate fund in New Jersey. We get $50 and a year, and it has to go into the library. I don't know about you. I could not have gotten anywhere near the big book and the step book if I had to go borrow it. I needed it at 3 o'clock in the morning when I was finally able to read. And when I wasn't able to read for the first 9 months, I hugged it and cried and went to sleep. I had friends inside that book. I heard about them. I heard you tell me about them. What we have done is try to get prisons that are on the borderline of the different intergroups, of the three intergroups, and we're trying to cooperate together. I didn't think it could happen, but we have a peacemaker mentor over here who helps us think we can do things that we didn't think we could do. And what's happening, of course, is we're doing them. I used to have a phrase that said, my dreams are God's realities. And this is what's happening today. Inner group from Cape Atlantic on this side is coming over to a place we call Bayside, which also has Southern State right next door. These are both state penitentiary facilities, medium facilities. They call them medium, but there are three lines of barbed wire. I want to see that, or you call that medium. Anyway, and our inner group is on this side, which is South Jersey inner group, and we've been trying to work through where they have our telephone number, that if anybody wants to get involved in the prisons, all they have to do is call any of the men or women on those, and we will get them clearances. What has happened is we need to get 8 to 10 people ready before we walk into a jail. We need to have 8 to 10 people who are clearable. If you want to call them Goody Two-Shoes or the Virgin Mary, you can call them anything you want to, but they're the ones that will walk the path to get in so we can get my thugs in behind them. Okay? It's you can call it point man, you can call it manipulation, but it's reality, okay? And that's the way it works for us. It's kind of like he said I could, but I didn't think I could. And he said I could, and she said I could, and now I could. And that's what's happened with thuggies. I couldn't, but they said I could, and they said I could, and now thuggies could, and I'm being banished from the line. But this is a typical prison list for us, and it has six counties on it, and the telephone numbers, and all the approved people. This is 31 on this, and at the bottom we have a list of Bridge the Gappers, including North Jersey, and we keep numbers available. I always say my number's on every AA wall. It used to be on the bar bathroom walls. Now it's on the AA bathroom walls. And you know what? It's really neat. I used to say to everybody I was saving one man at a time in AA. There's a story about that in the back of the big book. Okay, in the last minute I can read you all the garbage that's for real that we're supposed to do. One thing I know we have to do continuously is the third step. I wake up in the third step out of the big book. I can't memorize, and I'm grateful. I don't know where that went. I used to be able to do it. I think you know where it went, down the tube. But today it says in the 12 and 12 that I have to be persistent and consistent and must say it in 30 ways over and over in the third step. You don't give up 5 minutes before the miracle. Don't give up. Just keep at it. I'll get off the phone and I'll hang up from a superintendent. I'll hang up from a warden. I'll walk out of the office and I'll find my sponsor and use the best Al-Anon I know how to use. And I'll give her all the MFs and I won't give them to the office. Okay? And sometimes I walk out of an inmate's and I'll feel the same way. But it doesn't belong there. You know? Every one of us is trying the best we can to do the best that we can. And so nobody belongs with the trash. And by the way, I'm a New Yorker. I'm not a Philly. I'm a Philly from New Yorker. Be polite and consistent. I love thugs. I think they're all sweeties. Not all of them. This one's pretty sweetie. AA as such will never be organized. I covered that. And it says somewhere in one of the readings, and I don't know where it is, that you'll find your niche. And I had to look it up because I thought I knew what it meant. But to me, it was a niche where you crowd down and hid. You know, that was a corner for me. To me, I'm in your corner, you're in my corner, and this is my corner. This is our corner. I'm real happy with corrections. And I hope I never have to leave it. They keep telling me I have to leave it, and I find a way to keep coming back to it. So, too bad. It said, show up. That's the major thing. If you got a commitment or you don't have a commitment, show up. That's number one. You show up, you get up, you wash up, and you show up. And if you don't get up and you don't wash up, just drag your butt there and show up. At a prison meeting, the major thing that we're looking for is hosting groups. We're looking for groups that can be hosted. The Sunday night meeting, what is the step meeting in Ocean City? Has a step meeting. They bring us books about every 3 months and in cases. We're dealing with 2,500 prisoners. We're dealing with 300 of them at a shot. Don't worry, I'm used to it. we have things. I'm going to give you one last thing. I'm listening, boss, the broom. Lip service. Some places can't collect, some places can. It goes according to autonomy. We're going to leave these in the back. Literature in prison, it came from various places. And I'm done because they're making me.
Get the iron out.
I am going to end with a quote from Tom. When there's work to be done, the walls come down. Thank you.
Robbie, you all know. And Robbie is chairman of the area's Correctional and Treatment Facilities Committee. He coordinates the three intergroups in the 29 districts. As I said, he does a good job. But he also does a wonderful job as DCM of District 19, and he's in Cape May, New Jersey, where there's a Coast Guard station. Robbie has a way of getting the message out. And one of the neat things that he does every summer is that there's a film.
My name's Robbie, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. That's really a nice compliment, and I can accept that today. It's whatever. I couldn't accept that when I came in AA because I wasn't good enough. I wasn't worth it. But I really represent General Services for Area 45. That's my main niche for the last whatever 3 or 4 years. I had been I grew up as a GSR, a General Service Representative of my home group, which is the Primary Purpose Group in Wildwood, New Jersey, and And I just, it was kind of neat because, you know, I would just listen to the group, which is the biggest service structure, which I found out when I come to Area Services, the group, the AA group, you know, if you can say you're a home group member of an AA group, then you hold the biggest position that there is in Alcoholics Anonymous, because that's where everything happens. That's where all the decisions are made. Even though there's a conference structure every year in April in New York, that's where all the decisions get made. And that's what I learned. And I was a GSR for a while, and I went out to these boring, as far as I was concerned, assemblies and area committee meetings, and I really didn't like them at all. And I had no idea what was going on. I went out, and I really didn't like it. And then all of a sudden, I went to enough GSR meetings where it was finally time for elections, and it was ready. They were ready, you know, to, who was going to be a DCM. And as usual, you know, well, Robbie would make a good DCM, we think. And I didn't think so, you know. And they just all looked at me, and they all looked at me, and I said, you know, I'll, you know. And I got voted in as a DCM. And whenever I was in my drinking days, when I did something, I did it. I mean, I went all the way. You know, I ended up, I'm going to prison. I did it right, you know, and I would do everything all the way. And in Alcoholics Anonymous, I just learned if I'm going to do something, you know, I might as well do it right. And I read something where, you know, the good Lord wants us to be happy servants. You know, I've gone up to group treasurers and chairmen and all, and I said, why don't you just quit your position? Because you're not happy. You know, and the Lord doesn't want that. You know, he wants us to be happy servants. And that's what I had to learn. And I just wanted to do it right. And so now, since they elected me as a DCM, I figured I'm going to do it right. And I got to the point where if I'm going to be here, you guys are going to be here. Do you know what I mean? Like, I'm not just going to do this thing and just let everybody let me do it. And I get, like, major involvement from my district. We're the Hampshire area. We're a Wildwood, at Wildwood Crest, and Cape May. And look on a map in Jersey. We're on the very... There's nothing but ocean. We're in a little island. It's really neat. And we have 22 groups, and we have about, out of the 22 groups in our district, we have about, I would say, 20 groups that are actively involved in following the traditions and donating, and we have all kind of things going on, like, you know, and it's funny because we have this film every year at the Coast Guard base, and we had it last year. I get everybody there, and then I introduced the GSRs. I get them all to come up on stage, and it's a big thing, and, well, my group, I got the best home group, and we meet this time, and we have 18 meetings a week, and we're the, da, da, da. And it's like every year, now, we got people that dying to be GSRs in our district, because they want to go up on stage, you know, and they want to be seen, and all that stuff, and it works out, you know, whatever it takes. And the biggest thing, but then since I became a DCM, I was at, for about 3 months, I was in the area, and all of a sudden they said, and I think it was John had mentioned that they needed a correctional facility chairperson for Area 45. Now remember, we have people like Charlie, we have people like Steve, and a girl couldn't make it, a girl from Central Jersey Intergroup, Joyce, that we have three prison committee chairpersons from the intergroups. And our job as Area 45 is we wanted to know what they were doing, and we wanted to talk, and we wanted to be able to assist. And so my position as the correctional facilities chairperson for Area 45 was to constantly be in contact with these guys and see what they're doing and get their list, and maybe I could offer some assistance. Maybe we could help them go in and talk to some of the superintendents. We could work with Ginger, our CPC, our correctional, cooperation with the professional community chairperson, and just hopefully everything will intertwine. And so I sort of raised, they said they wanted somebody to do it. I believe I raised my hand to ask a question about something. And John said, oh, Robbie, you'd be great. See me after the meeting. I think I was just on to ask a question. I don't remember how I got the position, but I got the position. And so then, and what we do, and what we make sure, and again, I took over for Ginger, because Ginger did a great job over 2 years, and we have a lip service, a literature in prison service, big placard that we put on boxes that meet in all our groups in all of Area 45, okay? And then people put, you know, books in there and soft cover books and grapevines, and we distribute those to the prisons. And we also have a can, which we ask for pennies and dimes and nickels and dollars, and I take that money and I convert it into books for the people that are going into the different prisons, and I get that out to them, and through the I've gone to a few of them and shared, you know, with these prisoners too. And you know, the big thing that I really enjoy is just the fact that, and I'll end with just, you know, when we go into the prisons, you know, what I see and what is really nice is when they, you know, they know that we're coming in, you know, to talk to them. Like Joe talked about, it isn't the big message that we have to deliver, and I've been here and I've been there and I robbed it, but it's but it's just the fact that we don't have to be there, but yet we're going into these correctional facilities and saying, you know, you guys, and I had to say that, you guys are more important than whatever we have to do in this free world tonight. You know, like, we're willing to come in for 2 or 3 hours or in drive. You know, I was so perturbed when I got this position I'm very upset. And was my first area committee meeting. And I'm making my first report for the correctional facilities chairperson and this intergroup doing it. And this one, and he's not in it. He's not here anymore. He's not around anymore. He used to be the corrections chairperson for one of the intergroups. And he said, it's too far. We have to go too far to that prison. And I said, I don't care how far you got to go, and if it's in your district or there's a, but we're going to go to that prison. And, you know, and we're in there. We're in there strong now. We're in that prison strong. Because it does, you know, how far do you got to go? You know, and I hear people complaining that, well, this one intergroup's too far. We have to travel all the way to go to this intergroup to be involved and take. Oh, my gosh. You know, we know the things that Bill W. used to do to get this thing off the ground, to get this conference structure off the ground. He used to go from state to state. Heaven forbid we have to go 40 miles to do a little service work. Oh, my gosh. You know, and so anyway, I really have a good time at this. And we have a book, and it was back on that table last night. I think it still is. And it's called the AA Service Manual. Okay? And I really have gotten into it in the last few years. And it talks about being a leader in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and it talks about, you know, there's a line between, and I'm going to end with this, there's a line between motivation and aggravation, you know, and how do we get people to want to follow us and enthusiastic want to follow us? And that's my only, you know, my only goal in my area and in my district as a DCM, you know, is just to get people to want to be the next DCM. You know, what I do in area is not important for the next 2 years, but I want to make sure that we got about 4 or 5 people running to be the next DCM in my district. That's important, and to keep the groups going, you know, and to make sure the groups are having unity and all. And, you know, and I don't know. I just really enjoy this. I'm really grateful that Tom I asked us to come out and that we're here. And thanks, guys.
I don't win about it, but it was just necessary that we do it. And I gave him the job of doing it most of the time. And I tried to assist a little bit in the end. But we're real glad that they were here, and we really appreciate what they've had to say. It's been very informative. Let's give them another hand. Good job. Let's stand and close, please, with the Lord's Prayer. Our Father,
who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not in temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory. Forever and ever. Amen.
Keep coming back.
The words of your work.
Yankees and rebels.